We'll call it an investigation, a probe, a review, but we're not calling it an audit.
The Philadelphia Inquirer will no longer use the word audit when referring to the effort by the state's GOP to investigate the 2020 election. Why? Because words matter. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Also on this week's show, elections are under threat from so many directions that those who are sounding the alarm are having to get creative.
This is cable, so you can say it. How scared are you about elections going forward?
Well, I never expected to say I'd be scared. It's on CNN, but... And then he called me Professor Pottymouth.
And in Russia, the Kremlin's latest move to silence journalists is to label them foreign agents and make them declare it everywhere they go, online and off.
They could become professional breakdance buskers who work in the Moscow metro, and they'd still be foreign agents.
It's all coming up after this.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer, sitting in for Brooke Gladstone. This week, President Biden won the election in Maricopa County again.
Here's what Maricopa County tweeted. The Arizona audit draft report from Cyber Ninjas confirms the county's canvass of the 2020 general election was accurate, and the candidates certified as the winners did, in fact, win.
That politically motivated and widely criticized recount had been pushed by Arizona State Republicans last December after they met with Rudy Giuliani. It was part of a multi-pronged and baseless quest to overturn the results of the 2020 election. Just as the case was closing on the Arizona election probe, Texas announced Thursday it would begin a, quote, comprehensive forensic audit of its own. Meanwhile, Wisconsin and Pennsylvania persist with their Republican-led efforts.
The Republican legislature in Pennsylvania began pushing another bogus audit, this one funded by tax dollars, to prove widespread fraud that did not happen.
All these attempts to thwart the will of the people have not gone unnoticed in Congress.
You cannot have these states basically deciding who their voters are. If they had trouble in the last election, if they lost the presidency, then change your policies, change your candidates, change your messages. Do not try to change your voters. That is against the fundamental right to vote.
That's Senator Amy Klobuchar this week discussing the Freedom to Vote Act, a new bill aimed at countering the nationwide right-wing movement to restrict voting access. If you follow the coverage of this issue, you'll notice one word comes up a lot.
Officials in one county are still defending the integrity of the vote against an audit ordered by the Republican-controlled state Senate.
Audit. It's the word Republican lawmakers are using to describe the process of examining election results. But is audit the best word to describe what's happening?
Huge questions remain unanswered about the extent to which partisan political players might have a role in the process, so we're not calling it an audit.
That's Dan Hirshhorn, assistant managing editor at the Philadelphia Inquirer. His newspaper has started adding a box to its election coverage titled, Why We're Not Calling It an Audit.
We'll call it an investigation, a probe, a review. Often we'll describe it as a partisan probe or investigation or review. Other times we might put descriptions in quotations if they're attributed to other speakers, but we do not call it an audit in our own language.
Do you think calling it an investigation or a probe is any less damaging or any more neutral?
I think it's more accurate. I won't speak to whether or not any of these are damaging. The job of journalists in choosing language is to be accurate and precise. Audit is not an accurate word to describe what we know to be happening.
You mentioned that sometimes you'll put terms in quotation marks, and I've read that the Republicans were calling this a forensic investigation, so sometimes the Philadelphia Inquirer will put that in quotation marks. But I'm wondering if you think readers make a distinction. I mean, forensic investigation sounds big and bad and scary. Does putting it in quotation marks change that at all?
We believe our readers are smart and savvy enough to understand when we're saying something versus when we are relaying what others are saying. And even when we are quoting other speakers and describing it this way, we're providing a great deal of context and detail and reality check to make clear what it is and is not.
This gets at such a difficult decision that newspapers have to make, this how to use language, how to describe something precisely and accurately, when we have so much difficulty now as a culture agreeing on facts. I'm thinking even about Guantanamo, which I've covered for years. I try not to use the word detainee because they're prisoners. I mean, detainee, I think, understates what they are. And certainly there's been a lot of criticism of the term enhanced interrogation. I mean, say torture. I think most reasonable people agree that's what it is. And it feels like these election fraud claims raise the same problems. Audit is not the only word that is debatable. Have you found yourself wrestling over other words and whether they accurately capture what's happening when it comes to election fraud, voter subversion, et cetera?
We haven't had to wrestle too much with our decisions over usages of the word audits or really any other words because our coverage of voting rights and election administration has always been done in a way that is clear-eyed and puts the facts first, which made our decision not to describe it as an audit as actually a really easy one because it's flowed out of all of the coverage that we've done. In the run-up to the election, we were very clear-eyed in describing what then-President Trump and his supporters were doing, what the facts were. We never described his false election claims as being, quote, offered without evidence or anything of that sort. We simply called them false because they are false.
Have you felt the need to explain to Inquirer readers why you've made these decisions and why you wouldn't use the term audit, for example?
Well, yeah. In addition to our language in the body copy of the story itself, we have a box that is appended to these stories in print and online that explains that we are not calling it an audit and why.
Have you had any readers accuse you of being biased toward the Democratic point of view by not using the word audit?
Not that I've heard from directly, no.
In the Washington Post recently, Margaret Sullivan talked about the need for stronger language when it comes to election subversion. Words like fraudit. Jay Rosen has said that journalists need to enter what he calls emergency mode when it comes to covering calls of false elections and subverted votes. I'm wondering whether you feel like the Philadelphia Inquirer needs to enter emergency mode.
I'm not sure what emergency mode really means in a tangible way for our coverage. I think there are some critics who, in feeling that we don't go far enough, wouldn't actually be satisfied unless we did anything short of saying Republicans are bad. And that's not the role that we play. Even in this decision not to use the word audit, we're not making sweeping claims about the Pennsylvania Republican Party or any or even most elected Republican office holders in Pennsylvania. We are making tailored decisions based on individual stories as the need arises. I don't know what is actually gained by us going further than we are. I don't think there are readers out there that are waiting for us to make some kind of more explicit value judgment. And when we do, all of a sudden, they're going to have some greater clarity of understanding than they already do. Us saying that one side of the political debate here is not telling the truth, I believe, is enough for our readers to make informed judgments.
There are inevitably many more media outlets that are going to have to make this decision. We're now seeing that challenging election results is a political strategy intended to make voters and the public doubt the integrity of the election process. What's your advice to other media outlets who might not have thought about this yet? Do you believe they need to be ready and thinking now about how you're going to cover this and what you're going to call it, what words you're going to use?
The most important thing is to start this work well before the polls ever open. I was very proud of the way we did this in 2020. We were telegraphing to our readers for months beforehand that the election results would not be immediate in the way that they had become accustomed to, that the quote-unquote lead in the vote margin would change as mail ballots were counted, that this process would almost certainly result in an earlier quote-unquote lead for Donald Trump that would slowly diminish as mail ballots predominantly cast by Democrats were counted, and that whatever the result of this, what it's not fraud, it's not any kind of rigging, it is simply the system working, albeit slowly. It is the votes being counted. Journalists need to understand how the business of election administration is conducted in their states and in their counties so they can explain that to their readers.
That all sounds so sensible. Sounds like the way the world should work. But is the world, or at least the country, as it is the way it is, do you think that's good enough? Is it enough to correct the fact pattern?
I don't know if it's enough to correct misperceptions and misinformation. I don't know what else we could possibly do to correct misperceptions and misinformation. We offer our readers the truth and the facts. As you know all too well, people can pick and choose from a great deal of news media sources these days. We can't control what readers are finding elsewhere. We can control what we give them.
Dan Hirshhorn is an assistant managing editor at the Philadelphia Inquirer. Dan, thank you for talking about this. It's really interesting.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, what election subversion looks like here and in Russia. This is On the Media.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer, sitting in for Brooke Gladstone. Since the announcement of the Maricopa County probe, there have been signs that there was more going on than a good faith attempt to review the election process. For one thing, a June report written by Republicans argued that Cyber Ninjas, the company contracted to undertake the count, had been procured using an uncompetitive process and was using unreliable methods. Then there's the content of the Cyber Ninjas report itself. A New York Times story Friday morning quotes Adrian Fontes, the county recorder who oversaw the election, saying the questions investigators raised in the report reveal, quote, their purposeful ignorance and the fact that they, quote, don't understand the system. For example, the findings raise the potential danger of duplicate votes. But Fontes explains that the state has systems in place to reconcile votes in real time. And he says even raising that as an issue indicates a level of ignorance about how the county conducts elections. There are plenty more examples like that. Rick Hassan, a professor of law and political science at the University of California, Irvine, writes that this kind of obtuseness is a feature, not a bug. In a newly published paper, he lays out the three pathways to election subversion.
Everybody understands voter suppression when Georgia passes a law that says people waiting in long lines to vote are not allowed to be given water You can relate to that. That's voter suppression. You're making it harder for someone to register and to vote. Election subversion is something different.
One of the pathways, he says, is election official manipulation of election results.
One of the things that we know that's happened since the 2020 election is that a number of election officials who withstood the pressure to mess with the vote totals, they're now leaving. They face death threats. They face threats of violence. They faced intimidation. And in many places, they're being replaced by Trumpist loyalists, people who say that they believe or actually believe that the 2020 election was stolen from Trump. Those people are going to be in charge in some places of counting the votes and in setting up the rules for how votes are counted. It's a low-rent way of stealing an election. It doesn't happen very much in the United States because we have lots of checks and balances in place. But there was an election about a decade ago in a small Southern California city called Cudahy, where absentee ballots for the local election were sent to City Hall for counting. The ballots were steamed open. They threw away the ballots of the votes for challengers, and they kept the ballots and counted the ballots of those for incumbents. I mean, that's what I'm talking about, something as crass as that, something I did not expect to see in the United States. And it requires potentially changing rules so that there isn't transparency in the ability to recount votes, the ability to watch the process and control the chain of custody there.
And as you mentioned, there are many election officials who are just, they're done, they're leaving, they don't want to go through this again. That poses an opportunity for people to appoint new election officials who aren't as scrupulous, people without scruples who will do the bidding of those who want a certain candidate to win.
Right. I think there's a double whammy that comes when election officials leave. Number one, as you mentioned, the people that come in might lack integrity. But the other problem is the people that come in might lack experience and competence. And that raises the potential that people could take the mistakes that are made by new election officials, even well-meaning election officials, falsely claim that there's fraud or irregularities and use that as an excuse to try to overturn an election.
Another way that you say an election can be subverted is violence or intimidation interfering with election processes. Seems pretty easy to understand, but go ahead and explain to us or give us some examples of what that might be.
Well, we know that when Arizona officials in 2020 were counting ballots, there was literally a mob outside wanting to get in. We saw this in Detroit. There was just some very good reporting by CNN collecting some audio of voicemails with death threats to election officials.
234 years ago, the founding Caucasian fathers of America gave us the Second Amendment. Time's running out, Richard. We're coming after you and every that stole this election with our Second Amendment. You will be served lead.
And of course, we could have violence that prevents a peaceful transfer of power, that prevents someone from taking office, something like what we saw on January 6th.
Where are you, Nancy? We're looking for you.
When those who were counting the votes were targeted for violence.
I'd like you to spend the most time on the final way you think an election can be subverted, because you think this is the most dangerous and the most likely way, and that's usurpation of voter choice for president. What makes it particularly chilling is you said it sort of has the aura of respectability and expertise. So explain what usurpation of voter choice for president is.
So this is a really complicated point, so I'll simplify it just a little bit. The Constitution says the state legislatures get to set the rules for choosing presidential electors in each state, and each state sends their presidential electors to Congress to be counted. And there are rules for how that's supposed to take place. What we saw in 2020 and what could happen in the future is that state legislatures, which are given the power to set the rules for presidential elections, could be pressured or could decide to ignore the votes of the people through technical legal arguments about their power to do so. And despite the actual results of the election, they could purport to send in a different slate of presidential electors. So say we're talking about 2024, Biden wins the state of Arizona if you counted the votes fairly. But the Arizona legislature decides, you know what, even though we held that election, we think there were irregularities. So we're going to send in a different slate of electors. And then if Republicans control the House of Representatives, there's a challenge which electoral college votes should count. The Republicans decide to count the votes sent in by the state legislature, relying on technical legal arguments, which I think are unsound technical legal arguments, but relying on those arguments and claiming that they have the right to accept those. That would be a way, it would be a kind of respectable, bloodless coup. It would be a way of turning the election loser into the election winner. And rather than relying on kind of
outlandish claims of fraud like Trump did in 2020, ballot box stuffing or lasers changing votes. And, you know, it's really easy to counter that by saying, you know, there is no evidence of lasers affecting election results. But when the argument is, under the independent state legislature doctrine, if you correctly understand Article 1 of the Constitution, Section 4, and you understand Article 2, as well as 3 U.S.C. Section 2 of the Electoral Count Act, you know, it sounds like, oh, this person must know what they're talking about, when in fact, just a bloodless version of the same thing, trying to use false arguments to overturn an election.
You've said in your paper that the Supreme Court has left a gap open for state legislatures in a way that could be concerning.
So the best way to understand this is to look at an example from 2020. In the 2020 election, which we held under very difficult circumstances in the middle of a pandemic, there were lots of lawsuits related to the election. Some related to changes that were made because of the pandemic that some people thought were illegal, and some related to failures to make changes which rendered elections unconstitutional. So one of the cases that came up was a case in Pennsylvania where voting rights groups argued because of the pandemic and because of problems with how the U.S. Postal Service was operating in the middle of the pandemic, ballots were likely to be late in arriving to election centers to be counted. And so there was a lawsuit brought, and the state Supreme Court ruled that under the state constitution, the number of days for receiving these ballots to be counted in the presidential election had to be extended by 3 days. So rather than the ballots arriving on election day by midnight of that day, they could arrive within 3 days of the election. And that was a state Supreme Court relying on a state constitution to extend voting time. Well, Republicans filed suit afterwards against that determination by the state Supreme Court. And the argument was, by extending the deadline by 3 days, the state Supreme Court has usurped the power of the state legislature to set the rules for conducting a presidential election and conducting a congressional election, which the Constitution gives to the state legislature. Even a state Supreme Court relying on a state constitution doesn't have the power to do this. There were 10,000 such ballots that came in that 3-day period. And along the way, as litigation went to the Supreme Court, 4 justices on the Supreme Court expressed at least some sympathy with the idea that a state Supreme Court relying on a state constitution cannot change rules from any deviation set by a legislature in a statute. That is the independent state legislature doctrine. And Justice Alito, who was the circuit justice, the kind of the Supreme Court justice in charge of this geographic area in Pennsylvania, ordered that those ballots be kept separate, those 10,000 ballots. Fortunately, the margin in Pennsylvania between Biden and Trump was 80,000 votes. So those 10,000 votes, whether they were counted or not, was not going to make a difference in the outcome of the election. But you could easily see that if it had made a difference, if it had been determinative, there were at least 4, and I count potentially 6 justices on the court who would have been willing to accept this very muscular reading of the independent state legislature doctrine, that the legislature can act independent of its own state Supreme Court and its own constitution in setting its election rules.
What you just said, I think, is a good example of why this is actually challenging for the media to cover. It's quite complicated. What is the best way to bring this to the public attention in a way that makes it understandable?
Well, I've got a story about that, with the media angle, which is that I gave an interview to Jane Mayer of The New Yorker that ran about a month ago in a story called The Big Money Behind the Big Lie, in which I explained this doctrine to Jane, and she quoted me as saying that I was, quote, scared shitless. Right after I did that, I was put on CNN, and the anchor making these arguments, the anchor said, come on, say it, professor.
This is cable, so you can say it. How scared are you about elections going forward?
Well, I never expected to say I'd be scared on CNN, but that's how and then he called me Professor Potty Mouth. And so this got a tremendous amount of attention because, you know, academics are not usually on TV swearing. my paper is meant to sound the alarm. I kind of feel like I'm the climate scientist who says we're going to have terrible fires and flooding if the Earth's temperature raises 1.5 degrees, or like the epidemiologist a couple of years ago who said, you know, we're really not prepared for a pandemic. We're in that same level of potential catastrophic political meltdown, and all I can do is sound the alarm and hope that the media are going to listen and they're going to try and tell the story.
some of the challenges to election results have happened as a result of changes and accommodations made due to the pandemic. Drop box voting, expanded absentee voting, longer deadlines for ballots to arrive. If those types of changes and accommodations end, do you still see a great risk, or is it the pandemic in particular that opened the door to this kind of litigation?
I don't think it's the pandemic in particular. One of the things that surprised me about the 2020 election and the claims of fraud that were made by Trump and his allies was that they didn't rely on even a kernel of truth about election fraud and election irregularities. I had worried that the election was going to be poorly conducted because of the pandemic, and that there would be some major problem in Pennsylvania or elsewhere, and that this problem might make it genuinely difficult to know if there was an outcome determinative problem in a state, and that could then have been seized on as a basis for trying to overturn the election results, much like Bush versus Gore back in 2020, when the margin of error in how the election was conducted in Florida in 2000 greatly exceeded the margin of victory, and it was outcome determinative. But what I learned about 2020 was you don't even need a kernel of truth. If you're willing to shamelessly lie about the integrity of the election, and you're able to get enough attention, and that you're willing to get millions of voters to pay attention and to go along with the lie, then you've undermined voter confidence. You create the conditions where an election could be stolen. So no, I don't think it depends on the pandemic going forward. This was just a dress rehearsal for what might happen in a future election.
So how do you think that news consumers can watch for subversion in upcoming election cycles? Because as you say, it's often quieter than voter suppression attempts. And then what can they do to try to stop it?
I think the first thing to recognize is that because our elections are conducted in such a decentralized way, where it's on the state and local level, the rules that might allow election subversion happen on the state and local level as well. And so people need to be vigilant. They need to be looking at these rules for how elections can be challenged. Case in point, Texas. Texas just passed a very restrictive voting law. It's gotten a lot of attention. There was that whole walkout of Democrats. You may remember all of that. But the law ultimately passed when Democrats had to come back to Texas and the Texas legislature had its quorum again. But there was a provision in the original law, one that would have made it much easier to have state courts overturn the results of the elections. It changed the standard of proof. It changed the rules for what you would have to show in order to overturn an election result. That provision, after pressure from government groups and civic groups and others, that provision was taken out of the law as it ultimately passed. So I do think that there are things to do right now in every state. For example, and perhaps most importantly, every state should be voting with paper ballots. Paper ballots that can be recounted by an objective group, by a court, or by an independent body that's charged with doing so in the process of any kind of election contest. There's a lot that can be done right now.
What happens if we don't stop these attempts at election subversion? How high are the stakes?
Well, the stakes are the future of American democracy, because if you can't trust the vote count, you don't have a democracy. And so much has been done to undermine confidence in the election process. Even more undermining of that process would happen if election results were actually stolen. This is a really scary moment in American democracy, the scariest moment of our lifetimes.
Rick Hassin is the Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of California, Irvine, and he's also co-director of the Fair Elections and Free Speech Center. Rick, thank you.
Thank you.
The threats of election subversion in the United States probably sound more than familiar to people in Russia, where for years Putin has been consolidating his power through anti-democratic tactics. And in the country's federal elections last weekend, those tactics were once again on display.
Independent vote monitor Golas says it's been made aware of more than 4,000 possible instances of fraud in this election.
Observers say the goal was a high voter turnout to lend the election more legitimacy.
The Russian president is shown using a controversial online voting system, which critics say allows even more opportunity to manipulate results.
Victory for President Vladimir Putin's United Russia Party comes in the wake of a clampdown that saw many opposition politicians and activists arrested or barred from running.
In the run-up to the elections, the country's opposition leaders attempted to use what little power they had to put up an electoral fight.
A smart voting app, it advised users on which candidates could potentially unseat the ruling party.
The tool used to help voters vote strategically is an app built by the opposition and promoted by Navalny and his allies.
But the night before polls opened, that app disappeared from Google and Apple's app stores.
There is a particular agency in the Russian state body called Roskomnadzor, which is the internet regulator, also the media regulator. And so Roskomnadzor reached out. They said, you have to remove the app.
Tanya Loket is a media scholar and author who's been following the drama in Russia.
For a long time, Google and Apple just ignored these requests. And so at a certain point, their local offices in Russia were visited by court marshals who came along and said, there's a court order we have that says that this app was created by an organization that has been outlawed in Russia as extremist, and therefore everything they've created and published somewhere should also be removed.
Ah, so some law enforcement intimidation.
Yes, indeed. And, you know, usually the companies get these threats of fines, and like they've been fined multiple times for violating various internet-related regulations in Russia. And usually they just ignore this because technically the companies that deal with content moderation are based in the U.S. The legal entities in Russia are usually people who deal with sales or advertising. So they have nothing to do with the Google content or applications. But in this case, there were reports of direct threats of criminal prosecution for local staff. And I think that must have been what tipped the balance and tipped the scales, where they said, okay, we need to maybe respond to this somehow.
What was the Russian government claiming was illegal about this app?
Well, that's the interesting thing, because technically, if we consider the app on its own merit, it's not really doing anything illegal. All it's doing is offering voters information on absolutely legitimate candidates that are part of the ballots in all of the Russian regions.
It's like a voter guide. These are the candidates. These are their positions.
Exactly. The app is useful because it allows you to enter your voting district and it'll tell you who the most likely candidate is. So it's kind of a tactical voting thing, a voter information thing. But none of this is illegal in Russia. And in fact, several of the pro-government parties or conglomerations, they also created very similar apps that were not pulled from the app stores.
After the smart voting app disappeared in Russia, a cat-and-mouse game of sorts broke out. Explain how this unfolded.
Well, obviously, the Navalny associates were incredibly disappointed because, you know, they believed that both Google and Apple would uphold democratic ideas, and obviously they think of their app as a democratic tool. So they vowed to release the candidate list in any possible shape and form that they could. So the first thing they did, which was very easy to do, they just put it up as a Google Doc and shared it on their social media accounts. And very quickly, Roskomnadzor came back to Google and said, oh, we want you to block these specific Google Docs as well. And Google did. They also posted a YouTube video, which was a live reading of a fascinating list of candidates. And that, in a few hours, also got blocked. They just continued posting this list and sharing it in a thread on Twitter. They put it up on Reddit. They put it up on GitHub. They put it up on every available platform that they could. They shared it on Telegram. So they basically just flooded the internet. And then, obviously, other people also reshared all of these files and reposted them.
Russia has tried to censor tech companies before. Was the pressure to get them to remove this app different than previous types of pressure?
A lot of the previous censorship efforts, some of which were successful, LinkedIn, for instance, has been banned in Russia since 2016. Most of those censorship attempts deal with things like companies refusing to store data inside Russia or protest-related content that they refuse to take down. But this particular case is clearly a political issue where we see that it is because the app was created by opposition and opposition-affiliated actors is why the state wanted it gone, and that the companies conceded to removing this app based on this reasoning, to me, seems like a major precedent.
What's surprising about this is that Google is part of this global network initiative that pledges that when it makes decisions like these that might infringe on human rights, it will be transparent and explain its decision. But in this case, they seem not to have been transparent.
Not at all. And I think that, you know, that's what many digital rights advocates found incredibly disappointing, is that there is this position that Google has taken where it says, yes, we vow to uphold human rights standards and to be very detailed in how we evaluate our decisions that we make, especially in states where people's rights are already under threat. And then they go and do something like this and don't even deign to provide an explanation.
Since removing the smart voting app seems to have gotten the Russian government the outcome it wanted, it got the victory it wanted, do you think that will incentivize the Russian government to keep using these tactics to pressure tech companies in the future?
To me, what the most devious thing is that the Kremlin has really tried to frame this as election interference. So they're basically saying, by allowing this app to be hosted on your app stores, you are contributing to Western interference in the Russian election, which seems ridiculous. But the mythical proportions that this idea of election interference has reached in the U.S., it's a very clever framing.
This all sounds so dire. How would you advise tech companies and governments and our government to deal with this?
That's the big question, isn't it? Sanctions are obviously part of the answer. In many cases, these sanctions have already been applied. But I think there's probably more that both companies and governments can do. Companies, for one, can at least release statements and refuse to cave to this pressure, or at least announce why they did it and to explain the reasoning behind it. Just because a certain country has a set of laws doesn't mean that everybody should abide by these laws, because very often these laws couldn't be further away from what we actually talk about when we talk about justice, human rights, digital rights, personal security, where the law is clearly just aimed at ensuring that the state is able to control every aspect of our lives.
Tanya, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tanya Loket is a media scholar and associate professor of digital media and society at Dublin City University, and author of the book Beyond the Protest Square, Digital Media and Augmented Dissent, which came out earlier this year. Coming up, the 24 words being used to stifle Russian journalists. This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer, sitting in for Brooke Gladstone. In the months leading up to the Duma elections, the Russian government carried out a wave of crackdowns on dissenting voices, with the media bearing the brunt of it. But maybe not in the ways we've come to expect. This isn't a story of henchmen or former KGB, although they make a brief appearance. This is a story of death by bureaucracy. On the Media producer Molly Schwartz brings us the story of how a few Russian journalists are navigating their confounding new reality.
On July 15th, Sonia Groisman lost her job.
It wasn't the best day of my life, I can tell you.
Groisman is a 27-year-old Russian journalist who used to work at an investigative news outlet called Proyekt.
I did a podcast which told the stories of Russian doctors who were on the front lines against coronavirus, which was based on doctors' diaries. And it was the only podcast that conveyed a realistic picture of what was happening in Russia's hospitals.
But back in July, the Russian government went after Proyekt, calling it a, quote, undesirable organization and basically banning it from the country.
Undesirable organization means that all the projects, all the things we did became illegal.
Proyekt was releasing one high-profile, fascinating and impactful investigation after another.
This is Joshua Yaffa, Moscow correspondent for The New Yorker.
It specialized in the kind of brave, unflinching, hard-hitting investigations that were hard to find and weren't being done by outlets based in Russia.
In Russia, there are certain people, like Putin's allies, who you can't touch. But Proyekt went there.
Russia's interior minister, people from the so-called Siloviki, the very powerful top officials from the country's security services. They even wrote an investigation that appeared to suggest Putin might have a 17-year-old daughter from an extramarital affair, and both this young woman and her mother seem to benefit financially from certain ties to Kremlin-linked institutions and banks.
This is the kind of reporting that got the outlet shut down, putting Sonia Groisman out of a job. With her new free time, she took a trip to Sochi, a vacation town in the south of Russia.
Just to think, what's next? What should I do now?
On July 23rd, she was sitting on the coast of the Black Sea, just watching the waves.
This day was stormy, it was rainy, and I just was looking at the waves and thought, it's like my life, you know?
But then her reverie was cut short when her phone started buzzing like crazy.
20 messages in a minute. I started getting.
She opened one and clicked the link.
And the link to this list where my surname was 31 on this list.
Sonia Groisman's name had been added to the Ministry of Justice's list of foreign agents.
I realized that my life is going to change right now.
Since 2012, the Russian government has used this foreign agent label to shut down organizations it sees as antagonistic.
The wave of police raids against non-governmental organizations, foreign cultural organizations, and human rights groups continues in Russia, with the latest targets the Helsinki Group and Memorial, Russia's oldest human rights organization.
We are seeing a downright hunt for human rights groups. They want to force us to declare that we are foreign agents. They are hunting us down.
They went after Transparency International, the MacArthur Foundation, the election monitoring group Golos.
This foreign agent legislation was continually expanded by the Kremlin to cover more and more groups and more segments of society.
But in 2017, the law was expanded to specifically target the media. And in the last few months, they've been on a kind of spree.
So this all began in April, first with the targeting of Medusa, an online publication that had been founded by journalists who had found themselves homeless during previous waves of media crackdown.
A media startup called V-Times was named a foreign agent. Then the trickle became a stream, and then a river.
Then came Proyekt, then came an outlet called The Insider, which specializes in data-driven investigations and often cooperates with Bellingcat. After that, we saw TV Rain, a television channel, which was the largest media outlet named to the Foreign Agent Registry.
One of the most surprising things that happened in this time, the authorities started adding the names of individual journalists to the list. That's what happened to Sonia Groisman.
To become a foreign agent in Russia, you have to publish something on social media or in media publications and receive a financial transfer from abroad. That's all. Even if your, I don't know, American grandma will send you $20 and you post something on social media, yes, you are a potential foreign agent.
The Russian foreign agent law was specifically designed to destroy you, drive you out of business.
Alexei Kovalyov is an investigations editor at the news outlet Medusa. Brooke spoke to him when Medusa was first targeted.
But not in one fell swoop, like the government raids your offices and confiscates your electronics and arrests the journalists. No, it's not like that.
It's the bureaucratic hoops you're forced to jump through, says Kovalyov, that can be fatal for a news outlet.
We have to put a massive, ugly legal disclaimer on top of everything we publish, and that includes all ads and promotional materials.
The disclaimer reads like a big scarlet letter of legalese. It says, quote, this news media slash material was created and or disseminated by a foreign mass media performing the functions of a foreign agent and or a Russian legal entity performing the functions of a foreign agent. The same rules apply to Sonia Groisman.
Even if I post, I don't know, flowers or my cat, I have to put this disclaimer.
I checked out Groisman's social media, and that block of text, all caps, is in every post, every Instagram story, every comment, every response to a friend's comment.
Every time I post something, I feel that I'm taking a risk.
She'll be fined if she doesn't comply. First, 10,000 rubles, which is around $140, then 50,000 rubles, which is around $685.
And on the third time, there is the prospect of a criminal case. Up to 2 years of prison.
Just 6 months ago, Russian journalists would jump from news outlet to news outlet as some were shut down and others started up. But now, even that option is disappearing.
They could become, you know, professional breakdance buskers who work in the Moscow metro, or they could go, you know, gather mushrooms in the Siberian taiga forest, and they'd still be foreign agents, right? They sort of carry that designation with them.
Last month, Sonia Groisman went to a protest with a small group of journalists outside the headquarters of the FSB. That's like Russia's main security agency. They took turns holding signs, rotating one by one.
It is prohibited to protest in front of FSB building, but one-person protests are not prohibited.
When it was Groisman's turn to picket, she took the opportunity to perform some political theater.
I just came there with the sign on which I had written nothing more than the full text of this 24-word disclaimer.
The disclaimer. You know, the chunk of legalese I just read you a moment ago. And she was only there holding that sign for a few minutes before she was approached by men in uniform. What happens next is all captured on tape by Groisman. They grab her, take her to a police station, and sit her down in a large assembly room. A portrait of Putin hangs on the wall. An officer starts to copy down the text on Groisman's sign to include in her arrest papers. The police officer complains that the text on her poster is too long and the language so burdensome. He asks Groisman if it would be okay if he just takes a picture of it with his phone instead of having to write it all out. Groisman tells him that she's required to put it in front of anything she publishes.
And I was like, that's the law. And you're a policeman, you know? It would be great if you read it.
The entire exchange is documented in a podcast that Groisman started with her former colleague, Olga Churakova, whose name was also added to the foreign agent list in July.
We started recording a podcast called Privet, you know, again, which means in English, hi, you are a foreign agent, about what life is like for us in this new reality.
In the second episode of the podcast, which, like every episode, starts with the disclaimer, there's a scene in which Churakova tries to get a job at a fast food chain that makes blini, the delicious Russian pancakes. Churakova calls and asks if they have any open positions. The woman on the phone says yes, they're looking for cooks and cashiers. Churakova asks if it's possible to get a job as a cook without any prior experience. Yes, it's possible. Churakova then explains that she's a journalist, and she's been designated as a foreign agent. The woman on the phone says she's never heard of this before. But asked Churakova to write to her supervisors and explain the situation. Churakova does not get the job.
It is like the sign that you are holding on which there is a text, don't work with him and don't talk to him.
Tikhon Tsiatko is the editor-in-chief of TV Rain, or Dozhd in Russian. He told me about how it's the stigma of this foreign agent label that's been so painful for him.
For example, when you are designated as foreign agent, almost 100% that people from the government would deny talking to you. These 24 words, it's not the worst part, but it is the stupidest part.
The worst part, he says, is the idea that they're traitors to their country.
We think of ourselves as patriots, and everything what we're doing here at this TV station, over 11 years of its existence, we are doing for the best of our country. We just want our country to be better. I want my kids to live in a better place than the place where I grew up.
For Tsiatko, because he's Russian and he works for a Russian organization, and above all, he does this journalism because he really cares about Russia, that's what's made this foreign agent label so weird and confusing. But they'd been anticipating some kind of pressure from the government because of what they were broadcasting last winter.
If we want to isolate the most recent catalyst in this long story of increasing pressure and repression,
Joshua Yaffa.
It would be fair to talk about the poisoning and then return of Alexei Navalny.
Alexei Navalny, the leader of the opposition and official thorn in Putin's side. He was poisoned in August 2020, taken to Germany for medical treatment. Then he returned to Russia and was immediately arrested, which led to protests.
Not just in Moscow, but in dozens, if not 100 cities around Russia. I think the Kremlin was certainly spooked.
Tikhon Tsiatko said 10 million people watched their coverage on YouTube. And this is, I think, one of the most important parts of this whole story. Putin claims that Russia's foreign agent law was actually inspired by a law in the U.S., the Foreign Agents Registration Act of 1938, which put a label on outlets like Russia Today, media that our Department of Justice considers foreign propaganda. But Joshua Yaffa of The New Yorker isn't buying it.
I think it's a ridiculous and absurd comparison. As far as I understand, the FARA registration essentially ends there. In other words, you're added to the registry. You're not required to add some cumbersome disclaimer to everything you publish.
Being a journalist in Russia is kind of like a dance. Perhaps the Tropak, the classic Slavic folk jig that you might know from the Nutcracker. The dancers do these complicated whirls and squats and kicks as the music speeds up to a frenetic pace, leaving all parties panting for breath as the curtain falls. Russian journalists, too, are jumping and twirling, quick on their feet, just trying to stay a few steps ahead of the Kremlin and still perform the essential parts of their job. And despite what you might think, they are doing their jobs.
Independent journalism in Russia is perpetually under threat and under pressure, but it's not completely gone. And I think that oftentimes in the American conversation, we don't acknowledge the fact that there are these journalists who are still managing, despite all the difficulties thrown at them, do work that is extraordinary and worthy of our admiration.
We can still report things and we can earn money. We can be in the profession.
For Groysman's relatives who grew up in the Soviet Union, however, the fear is a little more ingrained.
My grandparents think that I have to stop it, you know, just to be silent. Someone on the top will forgive you and then exclude you from this list. But we have YouTube, we have Instagram, we have Telegram. We can distribute the information all the ways. Yes, it would be harder and harder to work as a journalist, but all the people cannot be silent.
The tempo is gradually increasing, but for now, the dance goes on. For On the Media, I'm Molly Schwartz.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Leah Fetter, Micah Lowinger, Eloise Blondial, Rebecca Clark-Callender, and Molly Schwartz with help from Juaria Wright. Zandra Ellen writes our newsletter. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Adrian Lilly. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. Brooke Gladstone will be back in 1 week. I'm Sasha Feiffer.